I am just going to come right out and say it. American consumer, you are amazing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 27th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have made no secret on this program of how much this economy depends on the American consumer. A lot is the short version. And come trade war, come tariffs, come global slowdown and talk of recession, you have never wavered. And today's report on consumer confidence just backs that up. Down just the teeniest of smidgens was consumer confidence. Way better than experts had been guessing, though. But, and honestly, if you didn't see the butt coming, well, I don't know what to tell you. But with so many other economic indicators looking less than rosy, what do you suppose consumers are seeing that nobody else is? Well, I'll tell you what. Four little letters, people. J-O-B-S, as Marketplace's Jack Stewart explains.
The Consumer Confidence Survey is a monthly look at how all of us who buy products and services are feeling about business conditions and the job market, and whether we're planning to splurge on cars or vacations anytime soon.
I think it's a little surprising that consumers have remained so resilient.
Lynn Franco at the Conference Board says consumers seem to be ignoring trade and tariff tensions and just looking at the parts of the economy that really matter to them.
And that's labor market growth, wage growth, and so far, so good.
As always, out in the real world, the picture's a bit more complex. Ryan Robinette had just folded his scooter to carry it into his office building here in LA when I spoke to him. He says, as an architect, life is good.
It's pretty easy to stay employed and switch jobs to get a better position currently.
Which is what the survey shows, too. The percentage of people saying jobs are plentiful right now went up from 45 to 51. But,
you know, long term with global warming and climate and all the weird, crazy politics, it's a little unnerving. So short term, good. Long term, not so sure.
Billy Richardson's an administrative assistant at a law school. She feels safe in her job, but she says her kids, though, who are in their 20s and 30s with good educations, are finding it harder.
They're having trouble lasting in jobs because, I guess, for them, the security's not there.
And that's definitely what 25-year-old Daniela D'Elia, who was out getting a coffee, is experiencing.
I'm on a limited-term contract where I work, so it's stable in the sense I know when the contract will end.
So does that impact the way that you think about the economy at the moment and how much you want to spend versus save, for example?
Yeah, because I feel like I can't spend as much because I don't know when I'll have a job after that.
According to today's survey, though, for now, that level of insecurity is the exception, not the norm. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Got a press release from the White House this afternoon. The president has announced his intent to nominate Eugene Scalia. Yes, he is the son of the late Supreme Court Justice, to be Secretary of Labor. Scalia, we should say, by all accounts, earned the job on the merits. He's done a previous senior-level tour in the Department of Labor. Also, he is a labor lawyer to boot. NBC News reported today that Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family, which owns the company that makes the opioid OxyContin, are offering to settle more than 2,000 lawsuits against them for somewhere between $10 and $12 billion. There has been, we should say, no official confirmation, but the news comes on the heels of yesterday's ruling in Oklahoma that Johnson & Johnson contributed to the opioid crisis there. After that decision came down, the Oklahoma Attorney General did something interesting. He brought up the announcement last week from the Business Roundtable that we told you about, the one where this big business lobbying group said there is more to being a responsible company than just boosting shareholder value. Marketplace's Justin Ho takes it from there.
Here's how Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter weaponized the Business Roundtable pledge against Johnson & Johnson.
Johnson & Johnson is a member of the Business Roundtable, and I'm asking the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, Alex Gorsky, to put his money where his mouth is.
Law professor Stephen Davidoff Solomon at UC Berkeley says this conflict is a test of Johnson & Johnson's commitment to the Business Roundtable pledge.
And the Oklahoma prosecutor is really saying, what is the substance here?
The substance of the pledge, to serve customers, employees, and the community alongside shareholders. Davidoff Solomon says the substance matters because people want to buy products from companies whose values they agree with.
We live in an age where people don't buy sneakers. They buy values that they can display on their sneakers.
We're probably going to be hearing a lot more from people trying to hold companies accountable for more than profits, says John Coffey, the director of Columbia University's Center on Corporate Governance.
We've got several presidential candidates who really want to change corporate law and corporate behavior and make them less committed to the short term.
So the theme's going to resonate. But will it actually change company behavior? Anil Shivdasani at the University of North Carolina says it might if the company already has other troubles.
So I think it just adds to the whole list of negative media publicity that companies can be subjected to.
Shivdasani says using the pledge to publicly embarrass a company might be a more effective tool than the pledge itself. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Don't usually do this because you never know when an interview is going to fall through, but we're scheduled to have Robert Kaplan, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, on the program tomorrow. I mention that because the former president of the New York Fed, a guy by the name of William Dudley, wrote quite the opinion piece in Bloomberg today, saying in almost this many words that the Federal Reserve should not be the enabler for President Trump's trade war. That is to say, as the economy sags, Dudley points out, the Fed should refuse to play along, refuse to try to offset the trade war's effects by stimulating the economy. Now, two things about that. One, the Fed, through a spokeswoman today, said this, and it's a quote, "The Federal Reserve's policy decisions are guided solely by its congressional mandate to maintain price stability and maximum employment. Political considerations play absolutely no role." That's the end of the quote. It's also what Chair Jay Powell says all the time, by the way. So that is the official line. Thing number two, and I'll tell you what, I make it a rule never to tell people what I'm going to ask them in an interview. But Mr. Kaplan, if you're listening, this is probably going to come up. Also, and not for nothing, but a quick correction from yesterday's broadcast. I said that Foxconn, Apple's biggest assembly partner, as it were, is a Chinese company. It's not. It's actually Taiwanese. My bad. On Wall Street today, well, the yield curve inverted again, so there's that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, change of gears here. When it comes to internet speeds, faster is almost universally considered better. I mean, when was the last time you heard about somebody moving to a slower connection, right? But is faster worth the extra money you pay? And also, do we need faster? The Wall Street Journal tested the premise. Shalini Ramachandran headed the project for the Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So first of all, can we talk methodology here? How did the Journal go about this research?
So it was pretty unique. We decided that we were going to get 53 of our journalists to put devices in their homes with this proprietary software that was created by researchers at Princeton University and the University of Chicago. And it's kind of a hard problem to figure out. What speeds do your applications perform at? And how does the speed tier you pay your internet service provider for affect the performance of the big applications that we tend to use?
All right. So what then did you find as you did this research? And I should say you were a guinea pig too, right? I read this piece and
I was.
And you were in it. Yeah. So is it true that you get better? Let's break it down. You get better HD and better streaming if you pay more for more bits per second.
What we find is not really. Basically, we saw that there was little improvement in resolution, which means getting the highest level of HD called 1080p when you paid for these faster speeds. And we found that the difference in the time it takes for your Netflix to start up is less than a second. And it's even smaller for YouTube and Amazon Video.
All right, so look, here comes the deeply cynical consumer advocacy question, and that is, are these internet service providers just snowing us with these packages of a gazillion megabits per second?
Well, what I will say is that they are definitely pushing faster speeds on consumers based on the premise that faster is better.
Yeah.
Really, for most of these normal things that we tend to do in a typical household, we don't need these super fast speeds. One thing that providers often say is, well, if you have multiple devices in a household and you have tons of people streaming at once, you probably need a faster speed.
Right.
So we wanted to test whether that was true. And so we asked all of our journalists to stream, you know, five, six, or seven things at once. What we found was that the user users who had speeds of 100 megabits per second or higher. So these are like premium users who streamed seven things at once. They only had used a median speed of 7.1 megabits per second.
Wow. So some huge percentage of their capacity is not being used.
That's right. So we're basically paying for a bunch of fallow pipe.
that's a good line, fallow pipe. Okay, but look, what if... And this is the way things are going, right? We're going to get the Internet of Things where our refrigerators are connected and our cars are connected. And we're not going to have just seven devices in a house streamer. We're going to have, 52. What about then? Maybe soon, someday?
That's possible. I mean, when we went to the companies with our study, they said, well, look, their applications like Ultra HD gaming, 4K, right. It's just been this thing that's supposed to be coming for a long time. But there's this idea that, well, we're helping consumers future-proof themselves.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you have to pay for it now. I mean, even if you have a smart fridge or devices that will turn on and off your lights over the internet, these things use very small pings of capacity.
Yeah, that's true.
Also, you're probably not using all 40 of them at once.
Right, right. So this is part of a whole series that the journal is doing on internet speeds and pricing and how it's paid for. We all kind of, it's a little bit like cell phones, right? We all pay different internet bills and who's in charge of this? And I mean, what's going on there?
Well, internet pricing is an unregulated marketplace, and we found in a study that we did of 200, we read 200 internet bills. It was a little excruciating,
yeah,
I have to say. We saw that for 100 megabits per second, you could pay anything from $25 a month to $105 a month, and neighbors can be paying different prices for the same speed. And we've asked people to send in their bills to check my bill at WSJ.com, and we've gotten a lot of responses so far. It's something that has been difficult for even the government to study. In fact, one professor we interviewed for the story said, in terms of legal markets, this might be one of the more opaque ones.
I'll tell you what, the Wall Street Journal graphics team did a great job on this one. Some really cool graphics in this piece about internet speed. You should check it out. Shalini Ramachandran at the Journal helped write it. Shalini, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Age may well be nothing but a number, and how you feel about that number varies directly with how big that number gets, but do not try telling any of that to marketers. By the time we reach our mid-50s in this economy, we've started getting hit with a steady stream of age-based marketing, much of it in the form of discounts designed to entice the older consumer. Restaurants, museums, car rentals, offers that can add up to hundreds of dollars in savings every year. But as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, some seniors are happy to pass up those opportunities to save.
When it comes to senior discounts, there are two types of people. The ones who love them.
When I was 45, I was ready already to be a senior citizen.
Ready already to be a senior when he was 45.
I was looking for a discount, but many people would say, oh, you have to be 55.
And then there are those who, even when there's a discount available.
No, I don't bring it up. If I'm not asked, why should I bring it up?
That's Hermogenes and Martha Barris, or as I call them, Papi and Mommy. My parents are from the Dominican Republic. They've lived in New York City for about 50 years and been married for 40. My father is 66, and my mother, she's not going to like that I'm telling you this, just turned 67.
Are you one?
Are you two? Are you 30? Are you 40?
Are you 50?
Are you 60?
They're retired. And that means every day is a chance to get senior discounts. So when they show up at the Guggenheim Museum, my father makes sure to ask.
How much will be the full one?
It's 25 for adults. It's 18 if anyone's a student or senior.
He's an unapologetic lifelong coupon cutter. So of course he knows where every single senior discount is.
I don't have a list, but I know exactly where they are. A restaurant, supermarket. Some local store when I go to buy wine, for example.
He goes on for a while. My mother, on the other hand, she'll take a 5 or 10% discount if it's offered. But putting herself and her age out there?
I don't think there is that incredible difference that would be worth it,
Someone passing by a discount It goes against the norm, says Art Cardin, an economics professor at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama.
The standard story in economics would be that anybody would take any discount they can get their hands on.
That's why businesses offer discounts. It's a way to target customers and keep them coming back. But sometimes, Cardin says, saving money isn't as important as saying something about ourselves.
We're willing to pay a price in order to construct certain identities that we find comfortable. Foregoing the AARP discount on a movie ticket, it might cost you a couple of bucks, but that might be a small price to pay in order to indulge the, let's just be frank, to indulge the fiction that you're younger and more vibrant than you actually are.
It's a standard economic trade-off, only framed by social identity. Is this worth that? Sometimes it is. One afternoon, I'm on a family outing with my parents. They qualify for senior Metro cards that allow them to take the bus and subway at half price. Before we get to the turnstile, my dad hands my mom her card. He's been holding on to it. As soon as my mother goes through the turnstile, she hands the card back to my father. When I ask her why, she blames her purse.
Because I know if I put it here, I will never dig it out.
Or is it because she doesn't want to be reminded of her age?
Oh, no.
My father gives me a look. We know the truth.
She don't even want to card with her. And then, you know, but this is okay, you know. She don't want to show that we are the same age.
Because of what it tells people about her. And as she gets older, sorry, mommy, what it may remind her about herself. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You're starring in the movie of The Great Laundry Day.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd buy a ticket to that one, to be honest with you. First, though, sure, let's do the numbers. What if I had said no, right? What if I had said no, let's not do the numbers? Dow Industrials off 120 points today, 0.4%. Closed at 25,777. The NASDAQ down 26 points, 0.3%, 78.26. The S&P 500 dipped 9 points, 0.3%, 28.69. There, Altria drifted down 3.9% today. The tobacco giant is in merger talks with Philip Morris International. Philip Morris shares off 7.7% today. Johnson & Johnson added 1.4%. How come? That's because the penalty in yesterday's verdict that we mentioned was only $572 million. J.M. Smucker, the packaged food company, dropped 0.8% today. Profits and sales down and below expectations. How come? Pet food. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Rihanna is a triple threat, at least, right? Pop music star and producer, actress, also a fashion entrepreneur. A fashion entrepreneur, by the way, who can see the handwriting on the retail wall. Rihanna has decided to take her lingerie runway show to Amazon. The Savage X Fenty show, it's called. It's part of New York Fashion Week. Is going to stream exclusively on Amazon Prime Video beginning September 20th. That is a loss for YouTube, where she live streamed last year. But as Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports, you have got to go where the customers are.
The Savage X Fenty show this year is likely to be quite the event. Look at last year's show. Canned laughter played through speakers as models wearing lace lingerie and garters sort of jumped around. There was a tropical theme. And the show included a lot of different women with different bodies, including a pregnant model who gave birth less than 24 hours later. Bronwyn Cosgrave hosts the fashion podcast, A Different Tweed.
This is all about the new age in fashion, which means that real people are walking down the runway.
Amazon wants to be part of the new age in fashion. It's been trying to grow its apparel and high fashion business. Michael Londrigan at the Fashion College LIM says this partnership could give Amazon some much-needed credibility in the fashion world.
Consumers have had the opportunity, you know, to purchase apparel on Amazon for a long time, but it really hasn't resonated.
There's something in this for Rihanna, too. Amazon has more than 100 million Prime members. That's a lot of potential customers.
You're going to see pop-ups for this, and they're really going to hype it. I think that they're going to really drive traffic to it.
Rihanna probably could have taken her show to broadcast TV or a different streaming platform, but Bronwyn Cosgrave says Amazon has something the others don't.
certainly the appeal for Rihanna has to be a potential retail collaboration. Amazon is ultimately a retail zone, unlike Netflix or network television.
So maybe Rihanna will launch an exclusive line that'll give Amazon some of the fashion cachet it needs. I'm Mary Elsegarra for Marketplace.
Brand, as we know, is everything. Consumers grow to trust them, whether it's cars, phones, politicians, actually, also your appliances. And into that brand value goes a whole bunch of stuff. A lot of it's substantive, yes, but no small part of it on the softer side. A brand's graphic design, for instance, or its color palette, or what the experts call its sonic branding. Think, as just one example, about that Intel chip sound logo, right? Bum, 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 bum. You know that one? Now, though, comes your washing machine and basically every appliance in your house. Laura Bliss is the West Coast Bureau Chief for CityLab, writing most recently about the purposeful evolution of appliance sounds. Laura, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So here's what we're going to do. Since this is an interview about the sound that machines make, we are going to play some sounds here. The first thing I want to do is, this is the sound, the old sound of a Whirlpool washer. Here it is. Okay, so that's the old one. Here comes the new redesigned one. Why is Whirlpool spending time, money, energy, and effort to do this?
Yeah, thanks for playing those clips. It's really kind of shows the transition that we're talking about. And as you heard in that initial clip, the last 30 or 40 years of this arena of industrial design has really been all about the piezoelectronic chip, which makes those really kind of familiar grating noises that, you know, you are familiar with from your fire alarms to, you know, your old video game consoles. And with the advancement in microchip technology, appliance manufacturers are also really trying to get into this game of making like bespoke, emotionally evocative tones.
And the premise here is that, first of all, it builds brand loyalty, but also, if we grant the premise from Whirlpool and these other manufacturers and the sound designers, it tells a story, right? As you write this in the piece, as you go to, you know, get your laundry out of the washer with that great sound, you feel like the sock folding hero.
I really love that description. And yeah, that's the idea. I mean, we heard, I think that was the introductory like startup cue for a washing machine.
it's but, great like, that there you know be... that. That's the great part.
Oh, yeah. This went deep. There's a whole set of custom composed cues that kind of walks the user through, you know, a whole quote unquote journey of the machine experience. And it's kind of supposed to follow this like emotional arc, like as if you're starring in the movie of the great laundry day.
But look, so let's take the washing machine out of this and let's go into the kitchen proper and let's use like a dishwasher, right? It's one thing to do this with, you know, have bespoke sounds for a dishwasher in a sound lab. But if I'm in an actual kitchen with my dishwasher, my microwave, my stove, my coffee maker, there's a smart speaker there somewhere playing, you know, Marketplace. Okay. That's a lot of noises. Can't we just, I mean, why?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's a really fair question. And as much as a kind of distinct sound that plays on the user's heartstrings might attach them to the product, there's also a really good chance that, yeah, it'll just become yet another notification noise in a sea of them and easily ignored or turned off, for that matter.
The catch, of course, is that it works, right? I mean, humans are amazingly responsive to sound. And, you know, it goes from the natural to, you know, whatever, wind through the trees or a roaring fire right in the crackle to like the Apple startup chord that plays to toot our own horn again, the Marketplace gong, right? You hear that gong, you know Marketplace is coming on, right? It works.
Totally. There's a reason that sound is so kind of, intimate and kind of wedges inside our brains. And that's kind of what these manufacturers are banking on.
Yeah. So, well, here comes the put up or shut up question. In your kitchen, what would you like? Would you like a noisy, tone-filled kitchen or would you like relative peace and quiet?
You know, it's funny. I started making sure that all of our like appliance notifications were turned on while I was writing the story, so that I could just get the best sense of what the landscape was sounding like. But now I think I'm actually mostly, honestly, most of the sound designers that I talked to for this story actually said they did prefer their appliances on silent.
Oh, snap. Come on. Really?
I think I fall in that camp.
Oh, yeah. Man. Laura Bliss, she's the West Coast Bureau Chief at CityLab. It's part of The Atlantic. Laura, thanks a bunch. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Kai. Pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the caveat that I'm a radio reporter and could be wearing my jammies for all you know. Saw this on CNBC. A new study from the staffing firm Randstad about office attire. A third of workers say they would rather have an informal dress code at the office than an extra $5,000 in salary every year. Also, about the same proportion, 33% said they would quit if it meant wearing business attire. First of all, what? Second of all, I would totally take the $5,000 and put on a tie. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial's off 120 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.3%. S&P 500 dipped 9 points, also 0.3% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Mutti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.